Thank you, Mr. Cole, our distinguished general chairman. And may I express my thanks to all of my many good friends here in this great city of Louisville. I suppose you're going to get tired of me. I come back so often to see you on all sorts of occasions. Everything from the General Patton Museum to the Derby to politics to UJA and you name it. I think I've been here. But I like your city. And I have enjoyed immensely over the years the opportunity of visiting with you. Tonight, I hope that I will have something that is worthy of your attention, because we're here for a purpose in which I have shared with you and with many other groups over many years. Let me first of all just express my thanks to your dinner chairman, Irwin Sherman, and his lovely wife, to all of those here who grace this meeting tonight with their presence, their leadership, and their generosity. To Ed Winkler, who's been my dinner partner as well, to Sam Rosenberg and Mrs. Rosenbaum, to Rabbi Kling. I didn't hear the rabbi's invocation, but I'm sure that it would have set me up good had I been able to hear it. I got here a little late. We express our regrets for that. There are many others here to whom I would like to say a special hello. And I want to thank Charles and Marion Weisberg, who waited for me about an hour at the airport. That's kindness beyond the call of duty. But when I arrived there, there were a number of young people, and I signed a lot of autographs, and they made me feel important. And tonight, when I came here to the synagogue, I found these wonderful young people that are here over to my right and to your left, over there on the wall, and I want to thank them very much for taking the time to come here tonight. It's a special challenge to me to have them in the audience, because sometimes I'm of the opinion that we don't bring them in as often as we should. Hopefully your community does. There's no reason at all for a generation gap except that somebody has to be mother and father and somebody has to be son and daughter. Other than that, may I say we ought to be on the same wavelength. This evening, as I listened to Mr. Cole, I thought right away, it just flashed through my mind, and I'm going to talk to you very much as just a visiting friend. I thought very much of what we're trying to do here is exactly what this great nation of ours ought to be doing as a republic and as a society at home and abroad. The UJA is dedicated to helping with the many social services that are needed here at the community level. And yet it has a greater goal, and that is to reach out to the people of Israel, not only to the people of Israel, to people of Jewish faith world over, to be of some kindly, helpful assistance. I always remember what Franklin Roosevelt said, and by the way, of course, that's my vintage. My first vote, my first real lively interest in politics was as a young man trying to take it, well, of course, personally responsible for Mr. Roosevelt's first victory. I knew that at the time. But I remember what he said once about government, and I paraphrase it. He said, the duty of government is not to see to it that those who have too much have more, but rather to see that those who have too little have enough. What he was really trying to say to us was that there is something greater about government than just corporate efficiency, that there is a message and a purpose far beyond that called justice. And if there's any one thing that I am mindful of as a student of Jewish history and theology, it is this central theme of justice. I used to teach a course in my church on Old Testament prophets. Now, there are no Humphreys in either the Old or the New Testament. I can't qualify at all. But I remember that my favorite prophet was Amos. I considered him the original New Dealer. And he used to speak out about justice, you know, and let it roar, come like a river, the waters of the river, you know, let it flow. I've always thought that the Jewish people their leadership in particular, and those who support that leadership have been mindful of the importance of social organization for justice, not just for power, and not just for wealth, not just for material goods, but justice. And tonight the UJA is engaged in that beautiful, wonderful mission of helping those who desperately need our help, in the mission of sharing, and in the mission of doing for ourselves here at home what needs to be done as doing for others who are less fortunate. Now that's what this government ought to be doing. That's what this American society ought to be doing, of which we are a part and of which you are a very significant part. Might I philosophize for just a moment? One of the great things that has come from the Jewish community in the United States, I think its greatest contribution is its dedication to civil liberties, its resistance to every form of oppression, its willingness to sacrifice its people, its goods, its name in the cause of human freedom. I think that the influence of the leadership of people of Jewish faith in this country on the courts, in business, in legislative bodies, in executive office, in the synagogue, in community action, has been essentially that of putting a quality of humaneness into this ambitious, power-driven, ever-expanding and growing country. Dear friends, when people get on a mission of conquest, whether it's the conquest of the land or the conquest of a people, whatever it may be, they tend to lose that sense of kindliness, of love, of attention, of justice, and of caring. And for some good reason, I'm sure it's almost providentially dictated that the people represented in this room, or you that represent people of many generations, you've seen to it that our country, your country, my country, has had a sense of purpose and justice. Today I worry about it. I'm going to talk a little domestic matters first, and then I want to talk to you about international matters. I've been in public life a long time, maybe too long, but I like it. And as long as I like it and people will tolerate me, I intend to stay with it. But I've always felt that the purpose of public life was, as I said a moment ago, that fulfillment of opportunity for people, that fulfillment of respect for human dignity, the fulfillment of the quest for human equality, and above all, of justice. When I serve in the federal government, I look to see how our rhetoric about the good life and good government and about freedom and dignity and the pursuit of happiness and all those wonderful words and phrases that we utter so easily, how that rhetoric is translated into action. And as a United States Senator and one who has been your Vice President and been in government from the position of a mayor of a city up to the Vice Presidency in the Senate, I know that one of the ways that government interprets its rhetoric is through its budget. Your federal budget, your state budget, your community budget, your UJA budget. That's the way that we put substance into the words that we talk, or that we utter or write. Today I see this government of ours with a budget approximating $209 billion. Almost one-fourth of the total production of goods and services of our economy. $269 billion. Only one other country in the world produces that much outside of ourselves. That's the Soviet Union. Japan, a little over $100 billion, and we stand in marvel, and we stand really awed by its unbelievable productivity. Federal Republic of Germany. None of them approximate even close to the amount of funds and resources that we put in our federal budget. And yet when you look at that budget, ladies and gentlemen, you find something that I think tells what is the thrust of this nation. Many good things. It is not all bad, to be sure. Much of it, most of it good. But in that budget, there is a continued emphasis upon weapons, power, in the form of tangible items, and the lack of emphasis upon the real power that is in the enrichment of our human resources. This nation is not as strong as its military might, even though its military might is awesome and will continue to be. This nation is not as rich as its gold reserves. Indeed, that's hardly encouraging these days. Nor as rich as the deposits in its banks. This nation is as rich as those young people over in that wall. That's the drawing account, ladies and gentlemen. They represent it. They represent what you would say in the commodity market, the futures. They represent what we call a long-term investment. Because that's why we pour money into our educational system, because we believe that the greatest resource, at least I thought we believed that the greatest resource of this country is the resource of its youth. Because all of us, like the plants of the field and the leaves of the tree, come in season and depart in season. There is a renewal of life, not so much in ourselves as in those that are our children. And I look today to see what's happening in this country of mine and of yours, and I am worried. I'm not worried because some of us aren't doing well. Frankly, most of us are doing very well. I'm worried because the fact that so many of us are doing well, that those who are being left behind seem all the more pitiful. Poverty in a government that is inadequate, insufficient, and in a country that has lack of resources may be forgivable. But poverty and lack of opportunity in a country that is graced with wealth and has within its midst hundreds of thousands of people of skill and ability and talent is nothing short of a crime. It's the worst form of corruption. And I see our government today pulling back. I see a budget, as one of my colleagues interpreted it, as one that is designed to make the comfortable more, to make those with comfort more comfortable. One designed to forget those who need our help. I hear a president say that we must be self-reliant. I don't need to be lectured to. Most people don't. Most of us are self-reliant and want to be. We take pride in it. We even bore our young people telling them about it. But none of us are totally self-reliant. And no one knows that more than the people of the Jewish community. You've helped each other. That's why you've survived. Otherwise, you would have been exterminated over the centuries. This country has helped each other. When de Tocqueville, the great French sociologist, wrote about America in the early days, he talked of that spirit of community, where if there was some that suffered disaster, that people gathered around and helped him or help a family to restore itself. We used to call it the old barn-raising ceremonies in days gone by out in the plains in the Midwest. And now we're told that we must be self-reliant. Let me just say to you quickly that for those that are maimed and handicapped, it takes more than being told. For those that are the elderly and the poorest of the poor and the unwanted, it takes more than just being told to be self-reliant. For those that are the victims of cultural deprivation for better than two centuries, many of our black brothers and sisters, it takes more than just being told to be self-reliant. For the child of the slums and the ghettos of American cities, where the spirit of community and the institution of the family literally hardly exists, it can't just be told to be self-reliant. And so I come to you tonight, and I come to you as one like you, privileged, fortunate. Every good thing has happened to me. A good family, a lovely wife, good parents, good fortune, good health. What more could I ask? But I know that my safety and my future and the future of my children and my children's children does not rest upon my present day comfort. It rests upon the moral commitment of this nation. And that moral commitment is not just to the majority. Governments that merely rest upon what the majority wants for the moment sometimes become governments that are indifferent to the needs of just people. I think that Jewish history tells us so much about this. And tonight, as I listen to Mr. Cole, and as I listen to Mr. Sherman, I couldn't help but think how it was back in those days of Hitler, when people thought it didn't make any difference, did it really? I mean, many of our people here at home, remember America, this great America itself, never went to the rescue of the Jewish people because of the immorality of Hitlerism. We went to the rescue because we were attacked at Pearl Harbor. We went in self-defense, not in conscience, not in moral outrage, not because humanity was being literally crucified and destroyed as some of its children were being wiped out. We went because we were attacked. My fellow Americans, I don't want this nation at home to want to do the things that it ought to do just because we think our home is going to be attacked, or our business is going to be attacked, or that we're going to lose our bank account. I want us to do what we ought to do because it's the right thing to do. I remember when President Kennedy one time mentioned to us about the communists. Many people said, well, we have to do these things that we're doing because if we don't, the communists will take over. And he reminded us once that maybe we ought to be doing some of the things that need to be done even if there weren't any communists. And may I suggest that's a pretty good attitude to have, because as we look down the road, you cannot be sure of the diabolical schemes of men in high places who know not popular elections, who do not feel any sense of responsibility to the public. Today it's a detente with the Soviet Union. I hope it lasts. I know that in many ways the peace of the world depends on how we, the Soviet Union, mainland China, how we're going to reconcile our differences or learn to live with them. I hope and pray to God Almighty that this so-called era of understanding, this new feeling, lasts and grows. But I would be unworthy of even your time tonight if I didn't tell you that there's so much in history that tells us that you cannot be confident of that. Therefore, what we need to do, we should do. And not do it because some devil is pursuing us or because someone suddenly has become more reasonable or more considerate. And this gets right back to what we're talking about the state of Israel. Israel deserves our help. Israel deserves our aid. Israel deserves our understanding, our friendship, our assistance, our confidence. Even if all the Arab nations around it were expressing attitudes of love and affection and reception and kindliness. And I say this now because I do hope and pray that we may find some way to move towards at least the initial steps of understanding and peace in the Middle East. And I do not think it will come quickly. Peace is not merely the absence of war, because if that's the case, then there is peace in the Middle East, because there is no war. But you and I know that there's no peace. You and I know that there is a consistent, persistent state of anxiety, of tension, of danger that consumes human energy and physical resources. But let me say once again that even if the United Arab Republic tomorrow morning should reach out in fellowship and friendship to Israel and say, all is forgiven, all is forgotten. We are brothers, we are Semites. Let us walk together. You'd still need the United Jewish Appeal. You'd still need everything that we're doing here tonight. And for years to come. Oh, I would say it would ease our problem. It surely would make it a better world in which to live. But I want my country and our government to understand this too, and this is where we come in. These meetings for me are not just a chance to talk to you about what you're going to do anyway. I know what you're going to do. You're going to be generous. You were generous a year ago. What was it, $1,400,000, $500,000? You're going to do better than that this year because you have to. There's greater things to do. I haven't the slightest doubt about that. I don't think I need to even ask you to do better, even though I shall. Because I think you ought to do better than you planned on doing coming here tonight. But I speak to you not as potential givers to UJA. I speak to you as concerned citizens. I want you to see that our country does well. Our government does what it ought to do. I want you to understand the realities of life. I want you to understand that Israel needs not only UJA, not only the bonds program, not only whatever you can think of, the JNF, I've been to all of them. I may not be Jewish, but I sure have been associating for a long time. We not only need all of those things, but we're going to need from the Congress of the United States the authority for the assistance and loans, for military assistance, to preserve that very precarious balance in the Middle East. Tomorrow morning, Israel would be delighted if we could get an arms embargo on all sides. I think this is something that these young friends need to know. Because I know what is said at university campuses. I hear what some young people have said. And I know that there are even movements like the Fatah, the El Fatah movement in the campus. And I remember that people have said, young men and women have said, even of Jewish background, why do we need more weapons in the Middle East? Well, no one really wants them. And I spent just the other evening with the distinguished Prime Minister of Israel in a very private little dinner with four senators, two or three members of the President's administration, top officials, at Ambassador Rabin's residence. And I can tell you that the Prime Minister of Israel tomorrow morning would be as happy as any person in the world could be if we could get an agreement that we could supervise, that there would be no further influx of arms from either the Soviet Union or the United States or anybody else. The Israelis do not seek weapons for the love of weapons. They seek them for defense and for protection and for security. And your Congress is going to be called upon to do something about that. Now you talk to them. Take nothing for granted in this day and age. Take nothing for granted. Be interested, for example, in the schools and the projects that your government has helped finance in part in Israel. Did you know that the budget, for example, for all assistance to overseas schools, which means a great deal to young people and elderly people in Israel, has been slashed in half? We may have to restore that. It's a small item. I want you to take a look at it. There is a need of grant assistance. There will be the need of some food for peace, some reserves of grain. All of that authority runs out this year. I want you to be interested in it. I want you to contact your senators and your congressmen. I want you to know what needs to be done. And I want you to keep in mind that, that while 30,000 people of Jewish faith were permitted to leave the Soviet Union last year, that maybe 40,000 will leave next year. I have just met with some of the Soviet officials. I have been in the Soviet Union. In fact, only this last week I met with Dr. Arbatov, the director of the U.S. Institute of the Soviet Union. I talked with Mr. Kosygin, my fourth extended visit with him. In 1969, I laid before Mr. Kosygin in the Kremlin the request, as a private citizen then, but the former vice president, a man who knew what Kosygin had promised President Johnson at Glassboro. I laid before him the request that he honor the commitment to permit the immigration of people of Jewish faith from the Soviet Union unto Israel. And when I returned, I sent him a 3-page typewritten letter reminding him once again of the commitment that he had made and pointing out that these commitments were tests of how we could work from here on out, not in anger, was I writing or speaking, not in arrogance, but in a sense of just citing what was the known fact. I hope that that little bit of help might have aided the improvement, at least in the immigration, particularly of the Jews from Georgia in the Soviet Union. Next year, more. This year, 30,000 or more. And every one of them, while offering a great asset, potentially, to Israel, is at the moment a tremendous responsibility and financial burden. And you know it. That's what this program's about tonight. Much of it tonight is whether or not those who have left this country that has political institutions that are very different from what we find in Israel, social institutions very different from what is found in democratic Israel, whether those people will find a place there, whether they can be assimilated, whether their children can have an education, whether they're sick and their elderly can be cared for. And if ever there was a need today for, at this time, for help, it is to help the Soviet immigrant that came to Israel. Now we have another great struggle on about the exit visa tax. And I took this case with me in December to every single minister of the consular ministers that I spoke with in the Soviet Union. I spoke with several of them up to Mr. Kosygin himself. And have laid it on the line as helpfully and as frankly as I could. And when I spoke to them, they said this is an internal matter. Without anger or without arrogance or being abrasive, I said to them, yes, and it is also a matter of great consequence internally in the United States. I had one say to me, one distinguished official, this is but a Jewish problem. I said, no, it is not. I said, interestingly enough, the so-called exit visa tax that you impose has aroused the opposition of conservatives and liberals alike, Democrats and Republicans, Catholic and Protestant and Jew, labor and business, young and old. And then I said, I'll tell you why. Because we consider it an offensive act to human dignity. And we have committed sins of our own. And we know a sin when we see one. And I ask you to take another look and to see whether this kind of reactionary measure is worthy of you as you seek to build confidence in the Western world. Now tonight, this weekend, our papers have been filled with the tragic, well, the report of great tragedy in Sudan. The Palestinian extremists, Black September, Munich all over again, and many other instances. Now maybe we understand a little better why the Israelis have had to take the kind of measures that they have. Many, when I've been in Israel, I've been so close to these borders to see young children, families that have been decimated by the attacks of a guerrilla band of terrorists. And yet, dear friends, I've been in the Hebrew University Hospital, Hadassah Hospital, some of you ladies of Hadassah, and I witnessed a half a dozen of these terrorists that had been captured and that were injured in the gunfight, being cared for as if they were heroes of Israel, cared for with the finest of medical attention, which I think tells something about the quality of the Jewish people in the state of Israel itself. But here this weekend, we saw an ambassador of the United States. We saw top officials murdered. We see terrorists exacting their price. And I thought maybe tonight I should just tell you that these people, these extremists, are doing more to jeopardize peace in the Middle East than any other single force. and that anybody that professes the love of peace in any country, communist or non-communist, east or west, that doesn't condemn this kind of terrorism and use all of the means at its command to wipe it out, they are but hypocrites, and they're unworthy of our trust or even of our consideration.